Hello, it's Thursday, 9th September. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. On today's show, Gary Bowerman from Checking Asia and I will be reviewing the six top talking points in travel and tourism during August. Will history write that it was the month when travel returned to government agendas? Let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So today's monthly review show, we're going to rewind back over August and also bring it up to date a little bit because we are already into the second week of September. August was a pretty eventful month here in Southeast Asia and one that finally saw some governments seriously considering their reopening strategies. Mixed messages so far, but at least there's some movement on the table. Before we start, we should look at the top story across the region last month, which is kind of behind this standpoint shift that we're starting to see amongst governments. And that, of course, is vaccination progress. Let's take a quick look at the COVID numbers for August and also have a little bit of a look at the latest vaccine stats.
Yeah, let's do that. So in terms of COVID cases, by the end of August, so as of 31 August, there were about 1.01 million active cases in ASEAN, and cumulatively cases crossed the 10 million mark across ASEAN. If we compare that back a month ago to the end of July, there were about 1.2 million active cases within ASEAN. So it has dropped a little bit, and it's interesting because the spread of the cases has changed as well. So whereas at the beginning of August, it was very much Indonesia that accounted for the bulk of cases, we saw towards the end of August, that the cases were starting to drop in Indonesia. And actually now daily cases are much less than countries like Malaysia, Thailand, and even some days in Vietnam, which I don't think I ever thought I would be saying.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, if you look at the figures are quite astonishing. If you look at the final day of July, the number of new cases was 37,000 in Indonesia. The final day of August, that was 10,500. Now, it's a little bit unclear whether those numbers are genuine, whether there is less testing actually happening. But even so, that's a massive drop. And so too, the number of active cases in Indonesia, which is really bringing down the whole regional total. I guess one of the things that we did notice last month, Hannah, is just this fact that COVID zero is totally gone now. Brunei, which was the last kind of bastion of COVID security in the region, has started to record daily numbers of new cases, which it hasn't done for a long, long time. And you look through the 10 countries of the region, every day there are new cases. But these new government shifts in standpoint that we're starting to see should mean that actual numbers of cases become less of an issue. You need to look more at the hospitalizations and the serious illness among patients. But you know, we're still seeing, aren't we, case counting every single day, and we're doing it ourselves. The number of cases has become a mindset thing across the region, and it's going to be quite hard to shift, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also comes down to transparency as well from governments and governments making that kind of information on a granular level, accessible and understandable. You know, one of the big shifts that has kind of gone along with this, you know, you said, you know, in theory, stopping case counting. But it's this shift towards the idea that COVID-19 is going to be endemic. And we have seen more ASEAN countries encouragingly accepting this during August. So, of course, I mean, Singapore was really the leader for this in the region. They were the ones who said, I think, the earliest that this is going to be endemic. But during August, we've seen Thailand accept it publicly. We've seen Malaysia talk about that. Indonesia, although I don't think they ever really pursued a zero case strategy in Indonesia. And Vietnam, which is probably the biggest U-turn of all. I mean, last year, there were such strict measures put in place in Vietnam. But I think there's been this recognition with this latest outbreak. You know, it's been around now since the reunification day, May Day weekend, so it's the beginning of May. It's still there. They've still got very high case numbers. And the prime minister last week finally admitted, you know, we're going to have to keep fighting this for a long time. So there is this slow shift towards COVID-19 being endemic. But like you say, they still need to make that jump then to be looking at not purely the case numbers, but actually what do those case numbers mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are two elements really in this sort of endemic acceptance. And that's really countries now have to start planning much longer term, not just about their tourism economies, but their whole economies, how they're going to rebuild different sectors, how they're going to create jobs, how they're going to alleviate debts and things like that, both for the governments themselves and among people. So that's one element. But also, this is all going to be driven by vaccination rates. And the priority at the moment in every country in our region is to speed up vaccinations. Some are doing better than others. But obviously, the big problem in our region, which is such a huge region, is differentiated population sizes.
Yeah. If we take Singapore as an example, Singapore now has reached over 80%, that magical mark that they wanted. Over 80% of the population has been vaccinated. And they have administered about 8.8 million doses. You look at Indonesia. Now, Indonesia is only at 14% fully vaccinated, but they have administered over 100 million doses. So they have done about 10 times what Singapore has done. You know, it's made up of thousands of tiny islands. You've got islands with no electricity. You've got a real logistical challenge when you're looking at countries like Indonesia, like the Philippines, like Vietnam even, versus vaccinating a city state like Singapore.
Yeah, absolutely. So Singapore, as you said, you know, has moved through this 80% barrier. Other countries in the region are getting towards that. Cambodia and Malaysia at the top level, just sort of surpassing around 50%, but both are increasing their vaccination rates quite quickly. But you look at the bottom level, there are four countries at the bottom in the region. That's Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, and Myanmar. Myanmar obviously has tremendous problems, but those three other countries, Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, you look at the size of their populations, 272 million people in Indonesia, nearly 100 million people in Vietnam, about 110 million, slightly more in Philippines. Vaccinating 80% of those populations, that's going to take time. However efficient your vaccination rollout programs are, however you can secure the necessary supply, as you said, the two island nations in particular, Indonesia and Philippines, the logistical challenges are immense.
Absolutely. So let's take a look at our next kind of big story that came out from August. And that has to be where we are, right, Gary? Malaysia.
Yeah, it was a busy month, wasn't it? And there was a lot of political issues happened. We saw a government fall. We saw a new government emerge, which was basically the same government as before, but under a different prime minister. We've had big economic problems here in Malaysia. The COVID-19 situation is not really getting much better, although the priority has shifted slightly. The vaccination rate is quite good, but the prioritization was in the big urban areas and the states where case numbers were highest. Seems to be having some effect, particularly here in Kuala Lumpur and the neighboring state of Selangor. But the problems have kind of shifted to the unvaccinated provinces, particularly in the north and on the island of Borneo. So overall, where we've come out of August is that the vaccination rate is moving. We have a new government. And the priority does seem to be now opening up the economy. There seems to be an acceptance that the lockdowns that we had, which seem to have lasted forever. I mean, in KL, I think we were locked down since the beginning of May, right through the middle of August. And it had absolutely no effect whatsoever. That's primarily because the virus, you know, it was already prevalent in the society before the lockdown actually happened. So sending people inside, keeping them away from everybody else didn't really have much an effect because it happened too late. But I guess in terms of travel and tourism, the one issue that has come out over the last few weeks is this pilot reopening of Langkawi, isn't it, Hannah? Do you want to talk a little more about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, this has been bubbling under for a little while. You know, we've seen the tourism minister, the prime minister, talk about reopening Langkawi, but not really specifying whether they were looking at international or domestic tourists. So last week, the prime minister announced, yes, we're going to open up Langkawi as a travel bubble for domestic tourists. But again, and you know, this is what really frustrates me. They announced that it was going to reopen. They said it was going to reopen on the 16th of September, but they didn't put any framework around that. And they had not really consulted with the, as I understand it, with the tourism stakeholders as well. So the tourism stakeholders were as much in the dark as the government, as probably many people in the government were too, about this reopening. So we didn't know whether it would be only for vaccinated tourists or not, who would even be able to travel. Now, this week, we're starting to get a few more details. So the tourism ministry has said that they would like it to be for all domestic tourists, no matter where they are, so long as they're fully vaccinated. These people would be able to drive to Langkawi from home to the ferry terminals, but they would need to get police permission. And this is, again, something that tourism stakeholders are pretty upset about, because who wants to start their holiday by having to go to the police station to get a police approval letter to say that you can travel to Langkawi? It just doesn't make much sense. So it's good that we're reopening, of course. And, you know, the tourism industry in Malaysia has been all but dead, really, since January. But when you announce these things, you know, we're 1 week out, we're less than 1 week out until this reopening date. You have to put some framework around this. You have to let people know who can travel, what are the rules going to be, so that they can prepare both the tourists and the you know, tourism businesses too.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of issues with this. And we produced a show last month, the year so far, in Malaysia with Faiz Fadlila, who said this exactly what you've been saying, Hannah. You know, he said there hasn't been any clear plan. He also questioned whether Langkawi was the right choice for the initial reopening. He suggested actually Kota Kinabalu might have been a better option, particularly if they were going to look at international connectivity. But that doesn't look as though that's the case at the moment. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's another of these cases. It's recycled thinking. You know, all governments should have a mandate that they cannot use the word bubble in anything that they do in future, because it is just such a phrase that has become just utilized too much. And it doesn't really mean anything anymore. This isn't a bubble. This is a pilot reopening of an island, a holiday island, that is very popular among Malaysian tourists. I love going to Langkawi. It's a great long weekend trip. But one of the problems here is that it was actually, as you said, selected the date, the 16th of September. Well, that's the Malaysia Day national holiday. So it's almost like they've actually tried to find a date, tried to find a place, and just put the two together. And as you said, 1 week out, tourists, the tourist industry, still do not know what the actual operating circumstances are going to be. I've been receiving, I'm sure you have, Hannah, messages on my phone, emails from the airlines offering really, really heavily discounted flights for next week. But we don't know if we can book because we don't actually know if we can go.
Yeah, it's crazy. So yes, it's a positive move. But, you know, would the industry just benefit more from allowing tourism attractions to reopen instead of just one specific island? You know, just get the staycations at least properly going and then do that. I don't know. Let's see. I hope that it will be a positive move and that these SOPs, Malaysians do love SOPs, will be released very soon.
The way that this has been put together, it is very haphazard, but you do suspect that other destinations, particularly places like Penang, Malacca, will be allowed to open probably during October for domestic tourists. But what we have got no clarity at all is about this pilot opening on Langkawi, how that would maybe set the framework in future for the return of international tourists. There's absolutely no information on that whatsoever. And we don't even know if that's even a priority, whether right now it's just going to be domestic tourists, maybe through to the end of the year, or whether Malaysia, because the economy is really, really struggling here, is going to look to do some kind of partial reopening before the end of 2021. At the moment, we're in the dark, and that's quite weird, given the fact that we're into the second week of September.
It is. So moving on to the next country, which has no problem communicating a dozen plans, is Thailand. of course, now the Phuket Sandbox has been going for 2 months. So it opened on the 1st of July. I think it has not performed up to the tourism industry's expectations. I mean, certainly the TAT predicted 100,000 arrivals in Q3. They are currently at about just short of 30,000 with September to go. It's not looking positive, is it? Especially now that Thailand is on the UK's red list. The UK is one of the top inbound markets into the Phuket Sandbox right now. But that doesn't seem to be deterring Thailand from coming up with more reopening ideas, is it, Gary?
No, you're absolutely right. And you know, you and I follow this daily. I mean, it's part of our jobs. We research and we try to find out what's actually happening. But we're both horribly confused most of the time. I have no idea what tourists or travel agents or airlines make of this scenario, because the rules just seem to change. And so, as you said, you know, so far we've had the Phuket Sandbox, we had the Samui Plus model, we've had this new 7+7 model, there's now going to be a Bangkok box. You know, every part of the country seems to be open with different regulations. You would like to think that Thailand has some kind of greater plan, but I'm not sure that it does. We have to say, I think, that we do admire their bravery in actually going ahead with this and actually trying to put something in place. But, you know, as you said, they have so many different plans. It confuses us. It confuses the industry. It confuses the tourists. And I'm pretty sure it confuses the government themselves. I'm not quite sure what the end result of this is, because however long this takes, as you said, it's been open for 2 months now, Phuket, and they've had 30,000 international arrivals. That's pretty low. And if you look at the figures that were announced, I think it was earlier this week, there was a survey done by the Bank of Thailand and the Thai Hotels Association. And they said that 38% of Phuket Sandbox respondents had said that foreign tourist arrivals in the first 2 months were lower than their own expectations. But actually, the average occupancy rate in Thailand is just 15%. That's up from 6% in June and July. So you could say there's growth there. But, you know, September is the start of the busy season for Thailand, and 15% average occupancy means that most hotels simply can't survive. I'm not quite sure at the moment where we're going in terms of actually building demand, because we know that Asian markets aren't really supplying travelers to Thailand. That's something that Thailand knew before it reopened. Long haul markets don't really seem to be responding. But, you know, you could say, well, there isn't any demand in the market at the moment at all. But then you look at what's happening in Maldives. You know, Maldives in August actually outperformed its own arrivals figures for August 2019. So there is demand for long haul travel or mid haul travel, and particularly beach type vacations. I just don't think Thailand is really tapping into it at the moment.
Yeah, I agreed. So, I mean, they're pinning a lot of hopes, I think, on the Russian market. I've seen TAT starting to talk about trying to attract the Indian market as well, who they reckon would manage to generate them billions of bahts by the end of the year. But I know exactly what you mean by, with each of these different places and provinces having different entry requirements, it doesn't make it easy for the traveler. I think nowadays people want to go to a destination where the rules are very simple. You don't have to read mountains of articles to try and figure out what it is exactly you need to do. But I mean, for Thailand reopening, the one that I'm really curious to see whether will go ahead is Bangkok. Last week, the tourism minister was saying they wanted to target the 1st of October. This week already, that's been pushed back to the 1st of November. And it's all hinging on this vaccination rate. They want to hit 70% vaccination rate. But for Bangkok, although they may well hit 70% by then, because this has been one of the areas prioritized, they say they're worried about the neighboring provinces. And of course, Bangkok is a whole different kettle of fish to open up than Phuket. Phuket is an island. Bangkok, the capital city, you can take public transport around. There's a lot of mixing, intermingling. How do you police that? That's really going to be one to watch.
Yeah, it certainly is. And you know, I think probably the one thing that the Phuket Sandbox has really taught Thailand, I think, and probably the region, there is no direct route back to 2019. Whatever happens next is going to have to, it's going to take time. I guess, you know, countries are going to have to make mistakes in how they promote and how they develop the tourism industries, because demand at the moment is just so slow. Here's a statistic that, you know, kind of will make eyes water. If you look back to 2 years ago, September 2019, Thailand received 2.9 million visitors in 1 month. Through the final quarter of the year, October through December, 10.34 million international arrivals. There's no route back to that. But whatever happens going forward, I think Thailand has to accept that and do something that will help at least build towards 2022 and then certainly for 2023, because it's going to be a slow road.
It is. So from one reopening plan to another, and that's Singapore. So Singapore in August's big news was the launch of their vaccinated travel lanes. Now, this is a unilateral initiative, so they have now forgotten the Hong Kong-Singapore air travel bubble. That is dust. So it's all about the vaccinated travel lanes now. It's all about the VTLs. So Singapore announced that they would allow travelers from Brunei and from Germany, if they were fully vaccinated, to be able to enter Singapore without quarantine. They would need to take plenty of tests. We're talking about four RT-PCR tests to be able to do that. There's a lot of conditions attached. Some of the kind of more interesting ones that they must travel on a non-stop designated flight, which only serves these vaccinated travel lane travelers from Germany and Brunei. You have to be above 12 years old, so that effectively rules out family travel too. And, you know, you need things like a minimum coverage of travel insurance. But, you know, it is a step forward. And it effectively has opened outbound travel from Singapore to Germany, because Germany does not impose quarantine either. Brunei still does. So this is, you know, the first chance Singaporeans really have to be able to undertake outbound travel to Europe, well, to anywhere, but specifically to Europe without having to quarantine on the way home. So it's a pretty significant move.
Yeah, it is. It's, again, these things are designed to start slow and scale up. But again, at the moment, I think only three airlines are actually permitted to operate these flights. Singapore Airlines, of course, Royal Brunei and Lufthansa. And one of the other things I didn't know before, Hannah, did you, is that there are 8,000 Germans living in Singapore.
I didn't know that. I know quite a few Germans who are living in Singapore, but I didn't know the exact number. I mean, so they had their first plane actually arrive yesterday on the 8th September, 100 arrivals. And interestingly, only 57 out of those were short-term visitors. So we presume maybe tourists, could be business travelers. The rest were returning Singaporeans or they had long-term passes. So, you know, we are going to see a big VFR segment, I think initially at least, perhaps not the leisure segment. And in terms of the RT-PCR tests, I was talking to a Singaporean outbound agent, and she said that the cost alone of those, she estimated, and I didn't check it, is about $800 Singapore. And I asked her how much a flight from Singapore to Germany was, and she said about $900 Singapore. It's very prohibitive, the cost, so.
Yeah, and the other thing I'm not quite sure, Hannah, I mean, you mentioned there that, you know, this is a start. This is Singapore at least making moves to open up international travel. It's chosen two destinations, one in Europe, obviously one here in Southeast Asia, Brunei and Germany. But it seems to be rolling back a little bit. I mean, yesterday, when that first flight arrived from Frankfurt, Singapore recorded its highest daily number of cases for, I think, almost a year. And it does seem to be rolling back. It has said that it probably won't launch any more new vaccinated travel lanes at the moment. So where does it go from here?
Yeah, that's the question, isn't it? Because, you know, in theory, I think Singapore didn't want to have to tighten back any of its old measures. You know, they'd said we're not going to go back to a phase two or a phase three. But like you say, locally transmitted cases are increasing. They're not looking at easing any other of their measures that are in place right now. It's got to be this interesting balance, hasn't it? And I think if these vaccinated travel lanes do turn out to transmit the virus, and then there are, you know, high profile cases that are linked to that, that could well dissuade the Singaporean support for this whole initiative.
And so just again, looking at the kind of methodology behind this, I mean, what do you think is the real methodology? Obviously, it wants to bring in some inbound travel, and it wants to allow Singaporeans under sort of very strict conditions to travel outbound to other countries. It's pretty unlikely many Singaporeans will travel to Brunei for leisure, but there may be some, as you said, VFR in there. Germany, I guess, is a different option. But do you think that one of the reasons they're not going to have more vaccinated travel lanes is simply from Singapore's side? Or do you think that maybe other countries just don't want to be a part of it right now? I mean, where do they go from here? Because, you know, you've kind of promised your population that you will start to open up and there may be travel, particularly over the Christmas and New Year period. But at the moment, that's starting to look a little bit unlikely.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think that's almost a problem, I suppose, with doing these unilateral openings, is that there's no guarantees of other countries opening back to you. So, you know, case in point with Brunei, they've still got these air travel pass countries where travelers don't even have to be vaccinated to skip quarantine, like for China, well, previously for New Zealand and Australia, although those are on pause at the moment, Taiwan, Hong Kong even. Perhaps they're just waiting for more moves from some of these other countries to see it, because like you say, there's not much point reopening and then those countries don't reopen back to you. It's almost a kind of a damp squib of an announcement.
Another probably important side point is these vaccine swaps that Singapore did recently, one with Australia and one with the UK. I'm wondering whether that is a kind of an indication of where they're looking at the next kind of sort of more advanced travel openings they're looking at. Singapore's been talking about doing some kind of deal with Australia for a long time. Australia is actually advancing quite quickly with its vaccination rollout, and it does look as though Australia perhaps to begin with will open up on a state-by-state basis. There is some notifications this week that perhaps that might even begin in November, certainly before Christmas. UK, we're not sure about how they would enter into an agreement with Singapore. But, you know, those are two real solid markets, aren't they, for Singapore, that you can see Singaporeans wanting to travel to. And you can probably see Australians and British travellers perhaps wanting to go to Singapore.
Yeah, but the issue, and we've talked about this before for Singapore, is how long can you reasonably spend in Singapore on a trip? You know, Singapore is really a stopover destination. it's really usually combined with other countries within Southeast Asia. Is there appeal to just go to Singapore only for a week, for 2 weeks?
I'm going to throw this into the mix. Those two countries, Singapore connects Australia and the UK.
Yes, exactly. I know that could be the key, right? Maybe it could be a three-way travel corridor, bubble, vaccinated travel lane, whatever acronym they're going to come up with next.
Let's hope so. But let's move on to the Philippines. A couple of interesting things happened there last month, Hannah. What have you picked out?
Yeah, well, one of my top picks for the Philippines, it's not a particularly exciting topic, but it's something that really should have been put into place much, much earlier on, is digital vaccine certificates. So, you know, as we know, Philippines outbound travel has been permitted since last year, and they have a huge number of overseas Filipino workers who are constantly traveling out from the Philippines to, you know, destinations worldwide. But the issues that they have been running into is that their vaccine certificates are not being accepted. So the biggest, most controversial one in August was with Hong Kong. And of course, many, many overseas Filipino workers working in Hong Kong. But Hong Kong actually refused to accept their vaccination status because they only had a physical copy of the vaccine certificate. And these vaccine certificates in the Philippines are all issued by each individual local government unit. And, you know, as we heard from Felice Axelan in our podcast in August about the Philippines, everything is very confusing when it's all at this LGU, the local government unit level, even to the extent that domestic travel, when it was permitted before they reimposed this strict lockdown in the Philippines, even that was becoming really tricky because each local government unit wouldn't trust another local government unit's vaccine certificate that, you know, it was true, it wasn't a forgery and everything else. So it's only been this week, finally, that the government have launched a digital portal where you can get your digital vaccine certificate, but only for Metro Manila, overseas Filipino workers, and some international travelers. Maybe, they said, maybe, perhaps within October, the rest of the country might get this. So what that means is even if domestic travel does reopen, there's still no kind of centralized way to authenticate vaccine certificates, which is still going to complicate domestic travel, let alone overseas travel.
And thank you for explaining that. The Philippines is another country that I find incredibly confusing. Two other developments that I guess we should note as well. One, which happened at the beginning of this month, Philippine Airlines has actually entered into Chapter 11 bankruptcy in the US. The airline is 80 years old, apparently. And it's actually going to go through a recovery plan, which basically means having to negotiate and confirm reduced deals with its creditors. There's talk that it'll actually reduce its fleet by almost a quarter, about 23%. It's going to slash some of its long-haul routes as well, unprofitable routes like London and New York. So that's something that we shall watch over the coming months. It's been a long time coming. It's no surprise. And Philippine Airlines says it is going to continue flying. But in future, it will certainly be a very, very different airline. The other point that I guess we have to note is what's happening. Well, we call it Boracay, but I think Filipinos say Boracay, is this idea that President Duterte is going to remove the moratorium on casino developments on the island of Boracay, which is kind of surprising, really, given the fact that Manila has kind of cornered the market for the Philippines, does very, very well, or it did before COVID-19, has some big developments there. And I think there are new casino developments in other places coming up, Cebu, I think, and Clark as well. But this idea that Boracay would suddenly become a casino destination is strange for a number of reasons. One, because it's quite a small island destination, but also Duterte closed it for 6 months in April 2018 after calling it a cesspool. It seems to be a kind of strange turnaround here. Well, what's going on? I'm not quite sure his presidential term is coming towards its end. But it seems to be a strange legacy to leave to the island, that, you know, we may see more construction on what is a beautiful island.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really strange move, especially when they've been talking about, you know, promoting sustainability. Building a massive casino resort does not really jive very well with that. So predictably, there has been the usual pushback from local tourism stakeholders about this. But the Department of Tourism has said, well, you know, it's Duterte's decision, and what can they do?
Yeah, I guess ultimately we'll actually see what happens in terms of investors. You know, there is some talk that maybe they might not want to go ahead right now, given the uncertainty there is just in the whole market, and particularly the Chinese outbound casino market, given that China is threatening to put in place quite strict regulations for outbound tourists from the country when it does reopen, visiting casino resorts and that kind of thing. So yeah, there'll be uncertainty, and you would imagine investors putting money into a brand new project in Boracay would perhaps have to take into consideration a lot of factors that 2 years ago they probably wouldn't have had to do.
Absolutely. And our last country story that we have to cover, if we talk about Phuket, we can't talk about Phuket without talking about Bali, right? We've been talking about reopening Bali for what seems like forever again. And there's still a lot of confusion over a reopening date. So if you recall the original reopening date was last year, but the 2021 reopening date, 1st of July, was obviously pushed back. Indonesia had this massive surge of cases we were talking about earlier. But the tourism ministry is still very reluctant to put dates on it. So we have seen all kinds of dates thrown around, from maybe end of this year to Q3 2022. As we keep saying with these governments, they need to really be clear and communicate their plans more with tourism stakeholders. Obviously, they can't control what the COVID situation is in the country. And now they're saying they need to look at what the COVID situation is worldwide before reopening as well. And that's obviously something that Indonesia has zero control over. But they keep saying we are still preparing to reopen. And this week, Sandiaga Uno, the Tourism and Creative Economy Minister, said they will follow the Phuket sandbox model. Kind of interesting that he specifically mentioned Phuket sandbox model. There's still a lot of variables up in the air about, is there quarantine, isn't there quarantine? Would you be able to travel on somewhere else? Are there going to be direct flights? Again, if it is going to reopen this year internationally, the government needs to set this out for tourism stakeholders.
Yeah, having said earlier, Hannah, there should be a moratorium on the phrase travel bubble. There should also be one on sandbox. I just don't think that should ever get used again, ever. But in terms of Bali is becoming quite interesting because, as you said, that there was some talk that maybe it wouldn't reopen until perhaps Q2 next year. The countdown is on because Bali is hosting the G20 summit next year. And Sandiaga Uno did say recently that he would hope that Bali was up and running and ready to host international travelers. I think he used the phrase some months before hosting the G20, which is towards the end of next year. It's an uncertain phrase. Nobody knows what some months is. Just a huge lack of clarity about what that actually means. I suspect it's because he doesn't know. I think the problem that tourism ministers have, I think it's a really tricky job being a tourism minister in government, because pre-COVID-19, the tourism minister didn't really get much kudos. It wasn't really an elevated cabinet post. It's become much more important now because governments have actually come to understand their tourism economy a little bit better than they did 2 years ago. But even so, I think negotiating through cabinet, negotiating through prime ministerial offices from the tourism ministry is pretty difficult. Yeah, it's subject to so many other factors. And again, as well, as you mentioned, Hannah, in these big countries like Philippines and Indonesia, there are so many local regulations. There are so many decentralized issues to manage, as well as the actual federal or centralized government issues. So it's a minefield. But at the moment, it doesn't look like there's much movement. But again, they could spring a surprise. Who would know?
Exactly. It wouldn't surprise me. So that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the show, our August roundup. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. And don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed or what we missed out. Drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show, or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yep. And as always, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue. We now have 100 episodes, Hannah. We hit the 100 mark last week.
We did, yes.
So you can catch up with our full catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or of course on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. As always, just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us, as that helps other people to find the show.
And that's a wrap for this week. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.